Good afternoon, everybody. I'm the Ron, and
I'm the Jeff,
and we've never done this together before, so it's the first time for both of us. I think there are some questions. So the way that we've kind of organized the session is that we came up with kind of three big questions, and we're going to individually talk about how we would answer the questions and with some examples, and then we're going to at the end of each piece, then we'll just open it up to the floor and almost make it a kind of interactive session, so we can get some feedback to what we say, but also hear some kind of views from you about what you think disruptive innovation is and what it means. Because I don't speak Spanish, I don't know how in depth the introduction was, but it went on for quite a while, so I think you probably have had our life history.
Yeah. Did they tell the part about the dog? No.
Okay. Great. Okay, so should we do the first question? So our first question, and I'm going to ask, I'm going to ask Jeff the question, he'll ask me. So what does disruptive innovation mean to you?
Thanks, Ron, and thanks everybody for listening in on this conversation. What is disruptive innovation? Well, what's disruption? What's innovation? I look to modern examples of how the world is changing around us, and some things are changing very quickly, some things are changing more slowly. But from a big picture perspective, two examples have come to my mind that I've been writing about recently. One of those is something called the Impossible Burger. It's a type of veggie burger, but the founder of it would never want it to be called a veggie burger. He calls it plant-based meat. We've all had veggie, many of us have had veggie burgers, but the founder of this company says, and there's a similar company you may have heard of, Beyond Burger, these are two brands, and those brands are very important, and we'll get into that later. But think of the Impossible Burger brand, and think of the Beyond Burger brand. The founder of Impossible Burger says that we're harming the world by eating too much meat, that animal agriculture is very bad for the planet and climate change. Now, regardless of what your position is on climate change or the contribution of agriculture to climate change, is the founder of this company for many years tried to persuade people to live differently. He then tried to influence not by persuading us in our heads, but by encouraging things like taxes on meat, by limiting our availability to have meat. And he realized putting on all of these conferences with government regulators wasn't changing people's behavior. And he needed to come up with a product that people who ate meat enjoyed eating. And through a lot of scientific research, working with consumers and top food scientists, they found that one of the parts of the hamburger that they liked was the not only the taste, but it was how it tasted like it was, bleeding, that juicy flavor that you have. And that doesn't exist in many plants, it exists in meat. But they were able to replicate that through identifying a little bit of this hemoglobin, leg hemoglobin, in the root of a soy plant, and they use genetic modification to mass produce it. And now they have a very popular branded product that the FDA says is safe. So let's put that aside for a second and think about another area where innovation, in my view, has been moving too slowly. One of the few products that we see, we look around, we see the video screens, we see our telephones, we see our cars. Everything is changing very quickly. But for a long time, one of the most, or I would say the most dangerous consumer product available hasn't changed a bit in many years, and that's the cigarette. And it's been in the news a lot lately, the e-cigarettes. There are a range of products that people can transition away from the combustible cigarette, the most dangerous form of consuming nicotine, to products like e-cigarettes. Some people talk about Juul. There are a range of e-cigarettes. There are heated tobacco products, again, that don't burn the tobacco and therefore do not present anywhere near the same level of danger as the combustible cigarette. Now, the best thing to do is to quit smoking completely, but if you want the nicotine without the harm, These innovative products are a great way to go. Yet regulators have gotten in the way, and I believe that's why we're not seeing, and we'll talk more about this later in the discussion, that's why we're not seeing the type of fast innovation that we're seeing on the Impossible Burger and Beyond Burger. But the importance is, and we'll get to it, is safety of these products. And if we don't have brands whereby consumers could identify the product, I like the Impossible Burger, I like the Beyond Burger, I like this type of alternative to smoking, then there will not be an incentive for people like you, the innovators here, to come up with new products that people could identify with.
I'm going to take probably an example which is closer to home or to my home. So I'm originally from Ireland, but I live and work in London, and I work all over the world on as a designer and a designer of packaging and a creator of brands. And unsurprisingly, as an Irishman, I work a lot in alcohol and in designing bottles, and it's tough work, but somebody has to do it. And so the research aspect of it is very intensive. But I have a friend, and his name is David Gluckman, and he's just published a book called, That Shit Won't Sell, and it's a book about innovation. Because he was forever being told that his ideas were just not marketable. But funnily enough, he invented a product called Baileys. And Baileys now is one of the largest global drinks and one of the most successful. And the birth of Baileys was a beautiful piece of innovation. And it came about because in the 50s and 60s, as you can imagine, butter is a very big product of Ireland, but it's a commodity. So the Irish government decided, and a very clever guy called Tony O'Reilly, who used to play rugby for Ireland, funnily enough, he had a clever idea that they could brand a commodity butter, and they call it Kerrygold. And then Ireland immediately had a value-added, branded commodity product that they could build an international reputation on. And it was hugely successful. And then some clever guys at a company which is now called Diageo, and back in the day was called United Distillers, they said, how can we kind of replicate the success of Kerrygold butter? How can we kind of do something with that? And David had just started a small advertising agency, and he got the brief. And they said to him, okay, the success of Kerrygold, we know it's butter, we want a drink. And his kind of creative leap was to kind of look at butter. Well, butter comes from milk, so let's start with the milk. What comes from milk? What cream comes from milk? So he started with cream. He said, what goes with cream? Coffee goes with cream, sugar goes with cream, chocolate goes with cream. So basically that's the birth of Baileys. It was a small man in an office in Soho innovating, literally going to the corner shop and buying a carton of cream, a bar of chocolate and melting it, some coffee powder and some sugar. And that process, and that created a brand, and that brand is Baileys. And I'm very interested in the process of innovation that kind of creates brands, and then the brand itself inherently within itself has an intellectual property and a trademark which cannot be replicated. It cannot be copied. And that's why branding for me is so important, because you can create a product through a process of innovation that you can make a big commercial investment in the development of, but then you can protect it in the marketplace. And that's really, really important. And that's why, and people trust brands, to your point. Well, that's what a brand does.
And Ron, I want to ask you about that. Yeah. For some companies, they don't have the backing of the entire government. In fact, some companies have opposition from government. What is it that allows innovators to be able to dream big, to do more? Is it that their product is so good, or do they have to attract investors?
I think it's a combination of both. I think innovation is, the design process that I'm involved in is sometimes we call it, it's always about ideas and ideation. And it's a point in marketing, we talk about a point of difference or a unique selling point. And that is somewhere inherent in the brand, in the ingredients of the brand. In the case of the burger, it's that kind of juiciness of
the
burger.
So that's a fundamental, you have to have that.
You gotta have it, otherwise you're just generic in the market.
But there have been companies that have come up with innovative ideas that have not become big, right? You need to attract investors to scale up, to be able to not only advertise and bring your brand to the public, but you need to develop. You need to hire people like Ron, right? Who can? Right? Before you're selling the products, right?
Yeah, I agree.
So my question to you is, without being able to protect that intellectual property that you have developed through branding and through your new ideas, how will you be able to attract investors, right? You need the ideas, you need something unique to distinguish yourselves, but then you need the brand. What value is the brand if you are an innovator, if you can't attract investors to fund your idea, to bring it to market, if that brand can be taken away from you? And that's what worries me. Well, because I always think about the promise of innovation, how innovation can make our world better, whether it's Impossible Burgers, if they're better for the environment, whether it's e-cigarettes or another alternative to smoking. One product that I know about is called SodaStream, and it's a way to carbonate water to make your own seltzer. In America, we're very lazy. So we like to have right there, we don't have to want to go to the store. SodaStream was recently purchased by Pepsi, and the SodaStream brand had become interesting. People were buying it, and then it kind of settled. And then it was purchased, some would say it fizzed out. And then it was not, sometimes this gets lost in translation. But Pepsi purchased SodaStream, invested in it because they believed in the brand. And now one of the biggest controversies, also environmental, is they're banning plastic water bottles. Did you hear about that? San Francisco Airport, you cannot buy a plastic water bottle. Now, instead of banning products, instead of banning e-cigarettes, instead of taxing meat, instead of banning water bottles in a major international airport, how about SodaStream? Now you could make your own seltzer, your own carbonated water, and instead of buying it and throwing it out, or even if you recycle it, you've got the same bottle that you can use over and over again. So Pepsi came in, they added value to the SodaStream brand. Now, I hope they're all making money, but to me, these innovative ideas are making the world better. My thesis here is we need a recipe for a better world. That recipe is 9 parts innovation and 1 part regulation, right? We need to make sure that the Impossible Burger doesn't have any new dangerous ingredient. We need to make sure that e-cigarettes are limited so that kids can't buy them. We need to make sure that SodaStream, that their product of the plastic and their product is not dangerous. But we need, as consumers, as innovators, and as regulators, and this is critically important, that regulators understand the risk of unintended consequences of too many regulations, because that will stifle the innovation that I believe can lead to a better world.
I agree. And in technology, for instance, speed to market is hugely important in technology, but also the ability to be able to deliver the product. And I'm the founder and investor in a company called LivingMap, which is a digital business. And we have been very lucky in the sense that what we're doing is not a tightly regulated market because it tends to be a business-to-business product. So we've been able to move with speed and attract investors, and that's been quite successful. However, when you develop community-facing, consumer-facing technology, you come up against other things. So if we take, and I'm relating an insight I got from a friend of mine quite recently, which is another way of looking at, so at the moment, Uber are in London, and they're in a lot of big cities, but they are constantly being, their license is constantly being questioned in London from the traditional service providers, who are the kind of the historic taxi drivers. There's a couple of different lobbies. There's the black cab, and then there's the minicab industry, and there's also, but it is all regulated by Transport for London. And Uber struggle to get the right side of the fence in terms of regulation. But interestingly enough, if you ask consumers about the benefits that Uber have brought to them, they were unanimous in the fact that they love the product because it delivers a fantastic service. And the actual issue here is not in terms of what's slowing down their ability, is that it's the regulations that are applied to the existing service providers that should be reviewed so that they are into an equal level playing field, as opposed to attacking the innovative brand. So as opposed to attacking Uber, what they should be doing is challenging the regulators to develop better regulation to allow the existing service providers to provide a better service.
I would suggest something even more radical, and that's allowing consumers to drive all of this, if you will.
Yeah.
Drive all of it.
Very good. That's your second cheesy joke.
Okay. But consumers should be driving this. Consumers demand innovation. E-cigarettes are not developed by big tobacco. E-cigarettes were driven by consumers who wanted to improve their health. They knew they liked the nicotine. They didn't want to harm themselves. And e-cigarettes and other products like it are being driven. The importance of flavors in e-cigarettes are being demanded by former smokers. On the Uber front, right? Taxi cabs, I live in New York City. Taxi cabs for a long time, especially in New York, in the capital, the business capital of the world, did not accept credit cards for a very long time. And the technology was there. In fact, they had advertising. In the back of the, you'd be sitting there and they'd have television advertising. But they didn't have credit card machines. They were getting video from space and playing that on the TV, but they didn't use credit cards because consumers had no choice. It was a monopoly and we didn't have a choice. Uber and Lyft came along. And they were allowing, obviously, credit cards. You didn't even need to use the credit card. Their technology jumped ahead of the taxi cabs of the regulated industry, which is, to me, a sign of the failure of the regulators.
Yeah, I agree.
And then what happened is, all of a sudden, the taxi cabs decided to start using credit cards, right? It's the consumer that can drive this in a very lightly regulated environment.
And the point there being is that the disruptor or the innovator is the one who has changed the behavior of an existing service provider by pushing the boundaries of what can be achieved. The same thing has happened in London. And it's actually, with the birth of Uber, the black taxi was kind of in decline because they were a cash-based business and nobody carries cash anymore in London. One of the things that they reacted to, and it took them quite a while, was to get in contactless payment in the black cabs. Suddenly, people are using black cabs again because it's really easy to do because you can jump in. And also, the black cabs are a really, really efficient way of getting around central London. So the disruptor has actually improved the business model for an existing service provider. So I'm just conscious, I'm going to say to the floor, is there anybody and wants to ask a question, or does anybody want to open up their heart about what disruptive innovation means to them? And then we move on to the second question. So, please. But we're not begging.
We could build in more questions.
Yeah,
we'll
do that. Okay, so we'll go to question two, which we asked ourselves. And we have been in deep talk about this, and this is what are the threats to disruptive innovation? What is it in society or culture or in our world that are the barriers to us being innovators? What do you think?
Well, we've talked about some of that with Uber and the taxi cabs. Sometimes the entrenched interests, right? The nature of being a disruptive innovator means you're disrupting something. So when you want to understand what are the barriers to disruptive innovation, and please keep in mind the importance of investment to drive innovation, what will scare away the investors? There's the threat to the brand, but there's the threat to the who you're disrupting. So whether in Uber it's the taxi cabs, what I've seen, and I, as you could see from some of what I'm talking about, I focused in on a lot of the, to me, the big potential public health benefits of disruptive innovation. On the e-cigarette front, we've heard, at least in the US, that there's this danger of e-cigarettes causing serious lung disease, lung damage, they say. Well, we know that's not from nicotine e-cigarettes. We've known from the beginning, based on the medical reports, it came from illegal THC marijuana products that had illegal vitamin, that something that should never be inhaled, adulterated products, vitamin E acetate, which was being inhaled to thicken the product, should never have been in these products. Now, the people who are against e-cigarettes, largely the pharmaceutical companies, which also sell nicotine gum, government-approved nicotine patches. They're trying to stop these new innovations. And my concern is that misinformation, poorly designed regulation will tamp down the promise of innovation, because now they're talking about e-cigarettes being dangerous because of lung disease. It had nothing to do with nicotine e-cigarettes. We see the same thing in the Impossible Burgers. Do you know, this is my favorite part of it. This is my favorite part of the story. Who are the enemies of Impossible Burger? Okay, that's an easy one, right? The cattle farmers, because they're disrupting the cattle industry. Now, you may recall, I spoke earlier about they were able to develop this leg hemoglobin, which replicated the meat from the soy protein, and they had to use genetically modified yeast to be able to grow this. So you know who was really upset? The environmental activists, the radical ones that opposed any type of genetic modification. Now here you've got an Impossible Burger, this new product that came about to improve the climate, to make the world better.
Save the world.
To save the world. And what did they do? They used genetic modification. Now, you know, genetic modification, biotechnology, that's the sacred cow of the environmental movement.
I agree. On the same, and I'll stick with the burger, and because it's just occurred to me. I was talking about it over lunch, which is my goddaughter is a food scientist, and she works for a company that was established by my, it's all godfather, funnily enough, our uncle, which is a global food business called Kerry. And so she works with food scientists. Her biggest client at the moment is McDonald's. And one of the things she told me was that McDonald's are probably the leading developers of non-meat-based proteins in the world. They are further ahead than anybody else. So if you look at things from a corporate perspective, if you're in, so McDonald's don't see themselves as in the meat burger business. They see themselves, right, in a, let's call it, they're in the kind of fun business, because they deliver a product that's an enjoyable kind of, you know, you don't eat McDonald's every day, it's a kind of treat or whatever. That's the business they're in. And they're not, but they are misconstrued sometimes as being in the meat business. They're not necessarily in the meat business. They are at the moment, but I think if you look carefully at what is going to happen in the next couple of years, they'll be migrating away from the meat business, or at least offering what we love, which is called consumer choice, which is about inclusivity and diversification. And brands will offer consumer choice if they can protect their intellectual property. It's a very, very interesting territory.
It's all connected.
We're there.
Burger King, Oh, great story. In the beginning of my career, I had the opportunity to meet with, and this is, just think about things in slightly different ways. I had the opportunity to meet with the director of nutrition at Burger King. And a lot of people laugh, director of nutrition at Burger King. Well, Burger King, like McDonald's, feeds a lot of people. So the person who held that role of director of nutrition at Burger King, I think, was important to the health of people. Now, yeah, it's not a health food product. It's a fun product. And people are going to choose to do things that are enjoyable that aren't always the best choice. This man had the opportunity to change how people ate. Yeah. Now, they sold, this is going back a long time ago, almost 15, 17 years ago. He told me that we, Burger King, decided to sell a veggie burger. And we ramped up and we did the consumer testing. And then, because we were getting so much criticism, he said, for being Burger King. So we decided, we'll sell a veggie burger. Then he said, you know what happened? Nothing. Nothing happened because nobody liked it. Consumers didn't come to Burger King to eat veggie burgers. In the past 15, 17 years, food scientists have developed more appealing products.
It's the technology that's driving the solution, you know. But the consumer kind of the consumer piece is always there. Do we stick with this one, or should we move on to the next one?
Let's keep going. I think we can move on, and then we'll get some questions.
So we segued the threats to innovation into can innovation create a better world, which is what's the kind of the upside of all of this? Of course it can, because the principle of a little bit like, you know, as human beings, that we're constantly evolving, we hope. and getting kind of smarter and more sophisticated. Innovation in itself is kind of how we bring ideas to life, and it's the process that makes, we hope, a better world, and our ability to kind of feed more people. I suppose a good example of how, we're stuck on the vegan thing, but we're just gonna keep at it because it's quite good. In the UK, there is a very traditional retailer, and they're not a fast food retailer. They kind of started off as a bakery, selling morning goods and confectionery, things like that. But one of their classic items is the sausage roll. And I don't know if you've ever been to the UK, but the sausage roll is kind of part of their, it's part of the kind of staple, apart from there's the Great British Breakfast, but then there's the kind of the sausage roll, which is effectively a sausage in pastry. But Greggs is a kind of traditional business and was plateaued and perhaps declining. And then last year, because they're clever and because the technology has got there, they developed the vegan sausage roll. And they developed it actually as a PR stunt, which was, so they got some clever PR guys that sort of said, how do we kind of reinvent people's perception of Greggs as not kind of stuck in the dark ages, but actually that we're kind of relevant as a food retailer now. And the PR guys, well, you know, do something that shocks the market. And that's what they did. They created the vegan burger because the technology was there to do it. It was the most Instagrammed, because there must be a correlation between veganism and Instagram. There's a relationship there, because I don't know. I don't get it. But there is. I don't know why. They're mutually kind of attracted to each other. So the vegan sausage roll for Greggs, it went gangbusters. And it one single product got people into the shops that hadn't been going into the shops, a whole new young generation of people. And not only did they buy the vegan sausage roll, but they also bought some cakes and some other bits and bobs and stuff like that. And that business now is back on its feet because of a piece of innovation which was unexpected.
Talking about the vegan aspect to this, just by a show of hands, how many vegans are in the room? Okay, so we got only a few. Does anybody know the best? other, so like two or three. Does anybody know, other than when you have an opportunity to ask a large audience to find out who's a vegan, what's the best way to know if somebody's a vegan? It's to be in a party with them for 2 minutes. They'll tell you.
Okay, very good. Very good.
You talked about things being driven by research, by innovation.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll challenge you on that.
Right.
Because I think, like everything that we're getting at here, it's not just innovation, it's not just consumers, it's not just technology, it's not just brands, it's not just potential for profit, it's not just regulation, they all come together. We talk about innovation. The innovation can come at different times. If there's no demand for the product, nobody's going to invest in the research that will lead to that innovation. So none of these pillars stand on their own. And that's why I'm always worried about the regulatory aspect.
Yeah.
Because consumers, our tastes change over time. We'll want one thing, we'll want another, and you know, you'll have these stores selling things.
Yeah.
Technology is always improving at a quickening pace. That's wonderful. You see, all of the drivers of innovation are moving in the right direction. But what worries me most is the only driver of regulation, or the only impediment to innovation is the driving force of regulation.
Yeah.
Always keeping it down.
Yeah.
And I think when regulation, especially poorly designed, overly burdensome regulation, we don't think about regulation as making life worse. We think about regulation as protecting us. And it's so critical that people understand, especially people in the creative space, understand the threat of regulation. We don't see how banning a product or taxing a product or putting big warnings on a product. We don't see how that hurts us, but it's important to be aware of it.
I'm going to do a little bit of self-promotion just for a second. So tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, I'm going to talk about endangered, I call it endangered species, which is the threat to brands. So I'll be here at 10 tomorrow, just plugging that. Hopefully you can all make it. And I'll kind of cover that in more detail. But one of the stories that I tell in that is a corporation story, which is about always trying to be ahead of and learning from the lessons of the past. So it's a Coca-Cola story. And it's how Coca-Cola are moving by innovation, by a process of innovation. And it's not necessarily just product innovation. It is behavioral disruptive innovation in terms of what they see as a brand. So historically, the perception of Coca-Cola as a brand was a sugar-based product. In the United Kingdom, we've decided that a sugar tax is a really good idea, which will help to reduce rates of obesity. Right. So I have some insight and opinion on this, and I'm quite vocal about it. I think that's nonsense. I think what will challenge, what it's a distraction issue. It's what, Boris Johnson, it's what he calls the dead cat strategy. When you've got a difficult conversation around the table, he takes out the dead cat and he puts it in the middle of the table, and suddenly the conversation is about the dead cat and not about what we were discussing. So in the United Kingdom, we have a health service that is creaking because we've got an aging population, okay? It's under huge pressure. It is underfunded by government. And we have obesity rates rising, okay? And the legislative solution to this is a sugar tax, right? Which is really easy, okay? That is so simple to do because it's called scoring points. Will they address the fact that our school children are not being educated to eat properly? They're not getting enough exercise because the schools have not got they've got health and safety regulations that don't allow the kids to climb trees or to run around and do things like that, because climbing trees is dangerous and running around in the grass, you could slip and break your leg or something. So our kind of children are being cosseted by health and safety. They're getting less exercise. They're not being educated to eat properly. So I'm ranting now because I get very passionate about it because I've got two kids. And it's interesting. So what Coca-Cola, going back to that story, so what Coke have done in the face of a sugar tax is they've moved their brand into what is called a portfolio brand, which is about consumer choice. So if you now look at the shelf of Coca-Cola in the United Kingdom, you've got what we call full fat Coke, which is a red can. We've got a zero. We've got a the Diet Coke, and we've got a Stevia Coke, which is the light brand.
Caffeine-free.
Yep. We've got, five you've got in New York. Basically, what they've done now is that Coca-Cola is a brand of choice, okay? So you don't have to have sugar all the time, but God, on a Saturday morning, if you've had a few beers on a Friday night, a full-fat Coca-Cola sugar hit is great, okay? But during the rest of the week, have a zero or a can of Coke. I love corporations that think ahead and that they re-innovate their corporate behavior and their business to follow what consumers need and what consumers demand and stay ahead of the regulators. So rather than change the recipe or rather than reduce the sugar content, they said, fine, we will have the red Coke. It's slightly more expensive, but you can buy the other products. I think it's very, very clever, innovative thinking and behavior from a big corporation.
I agree 100%. The big corporations don't always move that quickly. A little history lesson. Again, driving home the point of the danger of too much regulation. We talk about Diet Coke, Coke Zero, or whatever brand of product that you like that's lower calorie, that has a artificial sweetener. Coca-Cola doesn't like the word artificial, so now they have Stevia. But any of these products that make soda or some beverage sweeter without adding calories, so long as it's safe, I think is a good thing that gives consumer choice. One of the first diet sodas, they don't even like using the word diet anymore, it's Coke Zero, because apparently men don't need to go on diets. So there's Coke Zero for the men, Diet Coke for the women. The first product was Tab. The first product was Tab. And it had saccharin, an artificial sweetener. And there were studies after studies before they were allowed to put it on the market. And it turns out, if you think about sweet and low, it's the same chemical, there was a warning label on it that this product may cause cancer. Now, that was a long time ago. Eventually, only a few years ago, they took that warning label off. Why? Well, as they knew many years earlier, is that saccharin only caused cancer in second generation lab rats. So they would give it to the mother at very high doses. The mother didn't get sick, but the second generation male lab rat would get sick. Had no relation to human health. Now, at the time, this was the only alternative to full sugar soda. Yes, you could drink water. But this was an option for people who wanted something sweet. And they were so worried that it would cause cancer, they wouldn't drink it. And they had scientific studies of people who weren't drinking this. And there was a subgroup of people who weren't drinking diet soda who maybe should have. You know who those were? Diabetics. And diabetics who drank too much soda got sick. There was a set of people that were studied that did drink the tab with saccharin. Those people were studied very closely because they were drinking lots of tab. None of them got the type of stomach cancer that the second generation male rats did. Do you know why? Because the biological mechanism, we later learned, the biological mechanism whereby the second generation male lab rats, whose mother was force-fed tremendous amounts of saccharin, the biological mechanism doesn't even exist in humans. So we tend to be very careful. Let's put warning labels on this, even though we're not sure. But diabetics got sick because they were being too careful and not drinking saccharin, even though it wasn't a problem at the levels at which humans are exposed. So we always have to be cautious about too much regulation, too many warning labels. We don't always see the unintended consequence. Mm. The consequence of regulation protecting us is easy to see.
I think you're right. I think the enemy of innovation is, in a sense, it can be regulation, because one of the other things that it does is innovation for me is about speed. It's because you have an amazing kind of idea. Innovation is about ideas. It's about creativity. And it has to gain momentum. It has to have some form of inherent energy in itself, which helps because you're starting from ground zero. You have to build this kind of critical mass of onboarding people that are going to believe in the idea, support the idea, invest in the idea, all these things. But if this moves too slowly, it stagnates. It kind of dies a very, very slow death of 1,000 cuts, and it's over. But what happens in markets that are heavily regulated, or sectors that are heavily regulated, that slows the whole process down of innovation. And by the time you get the product to market, nobody is interested. It's kind of over. And if I'm a brand owner and I'm going to invest my money in bringing a new product to market, I want to make sure that it's commercially successful and viable. Otherwise, I'm kind of going to keep the money and put it in what we used to say, the post office. I don't know if you've got a...
Under the bed.
Under the bed is good, yeah. Anywhere like that. But not invest it in innovation. Because if I invest it in innovation that's too slow, it's a waste of time and money.
And that's why if we have an environment, broadly speaking, a regulatory environment that is always risk averse and ignores the unintended consequence, then potential investors, you know, it's easy for me as an expert to talk about brilliant ideas like the Impossible Burger or e-cigarettes or SodaStream. I didn't come up with any of those ideas, but I'm an advocate for that type of innovation. I don't know what the next big idea is that will make our world better. I have a clue, and it has something to do with, look at our biggest problems, look at our biggest challenges that we haven't been able to solve. But my concern is that if we live in this always too much regulatory world, who's going to want to invest in those new life? We don't know what they are yet. That's what's exciting about it. We don't know what the new solutions are, but why would people invest if they go into an environment where they're going to be stomped out?
Yeah, I can take it just slightly, remind me, and take it back to the kids in the playground again, because it's quite interesting in terms of going back to how actually direct and how, what role can innovation play in making a better world? So here's an example of innovative thinking that's created a better world. So going back to the kids in the playground, so health and safety, in terms of education, has become more important, that the enforcement of health and safety, than the health of the kids. Okay, so it's the health of the kid actually, in terms of getting out the right levels of exercise, and leading a healthy lifestyle, is actually not that important in the health and safety thing. The health and safety is really there to protect the schools and the Department of Education from anything that might go wrong, because they are so risk averse.
That anything that might go wrong soon.
They're petrified. They're like that.
Okay? Anything that might go wrong soon.
We don't know what it is, but anyhow, don't let them do it. Interestingly enough, there's a university in Scotland called the University of Stirling, and they come up with this really, really innovative idea, which is called a mile a day. And the mile a day strategy is that every school takes, every primary school takes 20 minutes, and all the teachers and all the kids walk for a mile a day. And if you can, you can jog it if you want, or you can walk really slowly. And within 3 months, so they experimented with a number of schools. This is an innovative piece of behavior. It fits within the health and safety regulations. It's in challenge to an obesity health issue that the government won't address. The schools and the university address themselves. They had a 7% reduction in obesity levels in 3 months of implementing a piece of innovative thinking about taking responsibility as grown-ups, as adults, about looking after the kids properly. I think that's, for me, it was a kind of stunning piece of innovative thinking and a real kind of game changer. The interesting thing is that then they took the study to the government, which is the Department of Health, and they asked the Department of Health to make it policy across the UK, and the Department of Health said it would be too expensive to implement, so they won't. So there you go. That's the regulators.
That's exactly how it works. When you think about what drives the opposition to innovation and the regulators, and who are the opponents, why would anyone oppose this? Well, we talked about the industries that are being disrupted. Earlier in the conversation about the Impossible Burger, I listed a couple, right? I listed the cattlemen, obvious. I listed the radical environmental activists who opposed any type of genetically modified foods or biotechnology. But there was a third opponent to the Impossible Burger, the one that I found most fascinating. In order for, so we talked about how you have to have investment.
Yeah.
So they have the Impossible Burger, it was selling, people liked it, they wanted to expand, they wanted to get into stores, into restaurants, but they didn't want to get into the vegan restaurants, right? Because the vegans are already eating the veggie burgers, right? So the target audience for the Impossible Burger was not vegans, it was meat eaters like me. So they wanted to get into restaurants that were known for selling meat. And they went to some of those restaurants, including one American chain called White Castle. And they said, let's go to White Castle. And the lawyers at White Castle said, wait a second, is it safe? Is it safe? And they said, yeah, people have been eating it for a while. No one got sick. They said, but the FDA doesn't give it the highest level of safety. In order to get the highest level of safety certification from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, you need something called generally recognized as safe, or GRAS. So they brought in the consultants and said, how do we get GRAS from the FDA? And they said, oh, well, everyone else who got GRAS did a bunch of animal studies. They did studies on laboratory rats. Think about the saccharin. They did high dose, and they got, the lab rats got to eat a lot of Impossible Burgers, so many until the lab rats died. And who didn't like that? PETA, the animal rights group, was furious at Impossible Burger, the company that's about to change, perhaps, the way we eat and save hundreds of thousands of cattle. But they killed 83 lab rats. And the animal rights groups opposed Impossible Burger because of that. There's always an ideology. There's always, whether it's ideology, whether it's the government wanting more taxes, whether it's the company being disrupted, we always have to look at the barriers to entry to a marketplace and what's driving those barriers. Very rarely is it a government official who just said, oh yeah, I want to protect children from this, or there's always something behind it, and you have to be skeptical about those.
Yeah, it's interesting, and kind of, we're winding towards, I need to do a little kind of mental summary for the audience. So it's primarily, this is a creative conference, and creativity, innovation is at the heart of creativity, and disruption. So when I went to what I call kind of drawing and coloring in school, which was really disappointing for my parents, who obviously wanted me to be a lawyer or some other kind of sophisticated individual. But actually, I went to art school and had a lot of fun, and had very long hair and very short trousers, something along those lines. Yeah. But the key to, and this is the kind of the call to, I suppose, we work in creative industries. We're associated with creative industries. We are either brand owners or our clients are brand owners. The process of what we do is about disruption, and it is about innovation. Otherwise, we wouldn't get out of bed every day. That's the joy, I think, one of the joys of having a branded world, where you've got product choice, where you've got color, you've got different levels of functionality, you've got dynamic technology, which is changing the game all the time. You've got innovation in terms of revolution, people like Netflix coming to the market. They started off selling DVDs. Now they're one of the biggest content distributors in the world. That is disruptive innovation, bringing an awful lot of pleasure and joy to a lot of people around the world. So I think for me, my little kind of, I'm summarizing myself, Jeff. It's a kind of just, I think it's a statement of fact that as a kind of creative community, being disruptive innovators has to be part of our kind of DNA in terms of what we bring to the table.
I think that's absolutely right, Ron. One of my mentors early in my career was a man by the name of Dr. Norman Borlaug. And he told me something that pushes me to get out of bed every morning. Dr. Norman Borlaug was an agricultural scientist. And he was the founder of something called the Green Revolution. He won the Nobel Peace Prize, And when he won it, he was credited with saving 1 billion, with a B, 1 billion human lives from starvation. Now, today, there's a lot of food out there. We've talked about maybe too much food out there, or it's too cheap. But at a time not that long ago, there wasn't enough food in the world. Today, people starve because we can't get the food to them, or because of political corruption, but there's enough food. And that's because people like Dr. Norman Borlaug went out into the fields and trained farmers how to use modern agricultural techniques. And he went out into the farms in Mexico. He got a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation and taught people breeding, how to breed plants, innovative approaches. If it was too dry, he would have drought-resistant plants. If the plants were blowing over in the wind, he'd have shorter plants that wouldn't blow over as much. And he used his scientific knowledge and brought it into the farms, into the work with the workers, taught the workers how to do this. And it was credited with saving a billion lives. Yet his technology, it wasn't such new technology, right? We've been plant breeding for a long time. But by taking it to the people and advancing innovative approaches to farming, he saved a billion lives. Before he passed away, we were working on some issues. And now keep in mind, this is a man who saved, who was credited with saving a billion human lives. And he said to me, while we were finishing up a project, and I worked in this very little space, and he worked in everywhere, he said, "Jeff, please continue the fight to protect the safe use of technology to improve the human condition." When a man who saved a billion lives says that to you, the hair on the back of your neck stands up, and it drives you to get out of bed every single morning with enthusiasm to defend the use of technology, to advance society. And that's what I ask everyone to partner with us in, is to defend the use of innovative technology to improve the human condition.
Okay. We had planned that we would kind of open the floor as we went along, and we decided, I mean, you got a New Yorker and an Irishman sitting in a competition to keep talking, and this could go on for a long time as a talk-off. But we've got this kind of 10 minutes on the clock. I'm happy to, if Jeff is, happy to see if there's any questions or anything else that you want to just throw at us. So do you want to, any hands in the air? Or have we just kind of beaten you down into submission with our barrage? Here we go.
There's a microphone is coming. Okay.
Since you're on the field and you've experienced the challenges and the costs of regulation, what would you say are the principles? Because regulation, unfortunately, is going to come anyway. So which would you say are the principles that regulation should comply with in order to be flexible enough to be prepared for the future?
Yeah.
From what you said, I mean, I can rescue like data-based regulation, not emotionally-based regulation. But what else would you say is important?
What I think is important, and again for this audience, because I think a lot of people here, again going back to this kind of question, is regulation versus self-regulation. So I work a lot, obviously, in advertising and marketing, and that involves effectively selling products and messaging and what you can and cannot say. I've always thought that brand owners, creative agency, everybody else should set very, very high self-regulation standards, which will negate the opportunity or the ability for a government, or what we sometimes call a kind of nanny state, to score points with regulation that is trying to get on top of it. So I would suggest that, and again, I've kind of been in markets where there's no regulation. The default is that unless you regulate your own sector to a very high standard, a government will take a cookie cutter approach. They'll find some regulation in another country, they'll photocopy it and stick it in, and that's it, and the game is over. So just from a personal thing, I'm a big believer in the creative communities and brand owners taking responsibility and setting their own regulatory standards.
I think that's a good textbook answer, but my experience in the real world, is that a good way? My experience in the real world, Ron, is that as much as an industry self-regulates, there will always be bad actors within the, maybe on the outside of the industry, but there will always be bad actors that will give the regulators a reason to come in. So as much as industry tries to self-regulate, there's always the risk that bad actors will come in. THC liquid is now damaging the nicotine replacement e-cigarette industry. It's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. I believe that when we regulate, and remember the title of my theory here is A Recipe for a Better World, 9 parts innovation, 1 part regulation. We need regulation. I'm not against regulation. Regulation, don't take me the wrong way.
For the right reasons. Go back
for
to the
right
health and
reasons,
safety thing. For
it has
right
to be
reasons.
Based on the science.
And with the right consequences.
And it has to be standardized. There has to be some level of predictability. Whatever rules you set, industry needs to have a level playing field so that people know what the rules are and then can compete under those rules.
Okay. Any more? I've noticed that people are just... Perfect, thank you. There's people kind of wandering out, and I'm kind of going, it must be that time when people kind of go, I can miss the traffic or I need a cold beer. It's one or the other.
Because I know they're not serving Impossible Burgers out there.
Okay, excuse sir. Me.
What about Colombia? What kind of innovation do you think we can create here in Colombia?
Okay, so it's interesting. I have a short answer to that, which is I think... culturally, Colombia is a creative country. I've been a bit inspired by the kind of history of this country. I mean, in fairness, I've only been here since kind of Sunday, but I've done a lot of walking. It is and I did a little piece of art, which is the kind of the door furniture, which is the door handles and the knockers and things like that in the old town, which are very beautiful. And there's, you know, there's more than 100 different variations of these things. So. It's already a culturally rich country, which kind of has creativity in its blood, and it's a colorful place. It's full of color. So just as a kind of alien walking into it, I kind of go, I think it's a fantastic canvas on which to build, you know, a creative economy, which is why I think this strategy we've been hearing about, which is the orange economy, I think it's a brilliant idea. You know, and I was thinking about trying to do the same thing in Ireland, but it wouldn't happen in Ireland because they're still kind of interested in tractors and horses and more traditional kind of forms of they still want to do stuff like that. But it feels to me that it could happen here quite quickly.
I think there's a lot of promise here. I think the people are so creative. There's so much potential. Again, I sound like a broken record, but my concern is the government getting in the way of people investing in this country. Because when you invest in the country, you're investing in the people of the country.
Yeah.
And there has to be predictable regulatory environments for people to invest.
Yeah. And I suppose, and I don't know, but education, I kind of go back to, I was very lucky to be the product of a good education, because education gave me choice and opportunity. And I think, and that is a kind of, it was an emerging thing for my generation in Ireland.
I thought you said you didn't go to law school.
So I think, and I think that kind of, you know, a belief in you can't really have the great idea of the creative economy and that we're all going to kind of become, you know, extraordinary, unless you put in the kind of the foundation stones of, you know, again, the Irish example is quite good because they've invested heavily in new technologies. So there is a lot of opportunity there for companies to come because it's an attractive workforce because they're skilled. So, but you have to join the dots. You can't just, I mean, we know that in terms of advertising, you can't put the message up there on TV and not deliver with the product. So if we're going to, you know, if the president is going to say that this country is going to be built on a creative orange economy, then you have to get all the building blocks in place. And one of those is kind of education, and it kind of starts in the playground.
Yeah,
got back to the playground.
And the lunchroom.
Okay. Any more? Oh.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
Do you really think that enterprises, that big corporations, are going to be auto-regulated? Do you think so? What I'm hearing is that we shouldn't have, like, kind of, yeah, like, oh, just let just regulate a little bit, but not too much.
No, that's not what I'm
that's
saying.
That's
a great question. It allows me to clarify.
Okay.
Yeah. I just said that I don't believe self-regulation will work. I believe we need regulation. But too often, the entrenched interests are able to influence the regulation to prevent competition, to prevent upheaval, to prevent innovation. We need predictable, science-based, limited regulation in order to allow for competition, to allow for disruptive innovation from small companies, from challengers, from anybody, big companies. You need a predictable regulatory environment with rules that are in place. Many people think in America we have a great system. The Food and Drug Administration now talks about using selective enforcement powers. It's going to decide who to regulate and who not to regulate based on what it thinks is a problem. That's like a banana republic. We need evenly enforced regulations. Everybody should be subject to safety regulations. They can't be decided by the FDA who we're going to regulate and who we're not going to regulate. You need regulations in place. But regulators need to be cautious that there are always effects of regulation, not always good effects. That's all.
Yeah, that's like the marijuana. When marijuana in the 70s was only grown in Colombia, everybody said marijuana is the worst plant in the world. Now that Americans plant marijuana in California, in how many states is marijuana legal? Like in 25 states, I don't know. How many states? Now it's legal in the states because Americans can grow marijuana. Maybe it happens when cocaine can grow in America or in Canada or wherever. When coke leaves can grow over there. I don't really get the anti-regulation thing versus the regulation thing. It seems like a utopia.
I agree with you. Right now, the problem of THC oil causing severe acute lung damage. The reason we have that problem now, I said before, is nothing to do with nicotine e-cigarettes. It has everything to do with the fact that it's an unregulated black market. The fact that it's illegal forces it into a black market where people can use a dangerous additive. We need regulation, but it needs to be limited to protect health.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay, so For me, I'd like to say thank you very much for your time and your attention and your questions, and also to remind you again that I'll be speaking at 10 o'clock tomorrow on endangered species. Please come.
Thank you, Jeff. Everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you,
Fran.